Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Amendment 1.
Welcome to episode 8 of While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Paul Bowers.
And I'm your other host, Jace Woodrum.
Today we're talking with some good friends of the ACLU about freedom of religion and freedom from religion, two freedoms that we derive from the First Amendment.
Oh, that's a really timely topic, for all of us, but especially for us at the ACLU, because it feels like white Christian nationalism and their attempt to kind of remake our country is almost overwhelming all the work that we do. We are seeing books being banned and classroom conversations being censored, that legislation to require the Ten Commandments be put up in classrooms, the funding of private religious schools with state dollars. I mean, we're really seeing this push to bring religion into public education.
Yeah, there are a lot of freedoms that are sort of downstream from the First Amendment. You know, if we don't uphold and defend freedom of speech, assembly, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, a lot of other things start to fall apart. At the national level, we've seen bolder calls for explicit white Christian nationalism. But for those of us living in the South, living in South Carolina, this is a struggle we've been dealing with for some time, unfortunately. Our struggle is and has been a preview of what the rest of the country has to deal with.
Yeah, and unfortunately, our state superintendent of education, Ellen Weaver, is one of the most powerful people in our state leading the charge for really forcing religion into public education. And, you know, I'm really excited that we have two guests today who have been working on this very issue, the separation of church and state, the issues of, you know, freedom of religion and freedom from religion. One of those guests is Dr. Bonnie Cleveland. She's a leader with the Secular Humanists of the Lowcountry. In addition to her advocacy with that group, she has also found herself tangled up in a fight over comprehensive sex education in the Charleston County School District.
Our other guest is Dr. Herb Silverman, founder of the Secular Humanists of the Lowcountry, as well as the Secular Coalition for America. As we'll discuss in this episode, Herb and the ACLU of South Carolina go way back to the 90s. Long before you or I joined staff, he was the plaintiff in a crucial religious freedom case before the South Carolina Supreme Court.
Now, before we get into the interview, I want to thank the listeners who have been following along for the first 7 episodes. Y'all, we see you and we love to hear from you.
Same. As the guy who records and edits all of these, I love hearing from listeners, whether it's to compliment our work or to issue a fact check or just to let us know you're listening.
Really, so true. And you know what? If I could make one request of you, our listeners, it's this. Please help spread the word about this podcast. Give us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Share the episodes with your friends in person, share it on social media. Help us find more listeners.
Hear, hear. All right, without further ado, let's get into it. Bonnie, Herb, welcome. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for inviting us.
Good to see you, Paul.
So let's start with some current events. I recently got a call from a news reporter, I know Bonnie, you did too, asking about the possibility of South Carolina adopting a law like Louisiana's, mandating that a version of the Ten Commandments be displayed in public school classrooms. This is kind of a softball warm-up question for the two of you, I know, but what are the odds of a law like that passing in South Carolina? And what is so wrong with it? Why would you oppose a law like that?
Well, I could say this happened in 1998 when Tim Scott, who was a Charleston County Council member at the time, insisted on posting the Ten Commandments plaque on the wall of the council chambers, ignoring advice that he would lose the anticipated legal challenge. So Scott responded that the display was needed to remind residents of moral absolutes. As expected, the court declared the display unconstitutional, and taxpayers were left with a bill for legal costs, which was quite substantial. Scott is now our U.S. senator and a real strong Trump supporter. Now, posting the Ten Commandments in government building allies the government with two creeds, Judaism and Christianity, and sends a message to Americans of other faiths and none that they are second-class citizens. I'd like to say a couple other things about the Ten Commandments. Most people believe that they're among the finest guidelines for a virtuous life, but few can name them all. The first four are religious edicts that have nothing to do with ethical behavior. They describe how to worship and pay homage to a jealous and vindictive God. The tenth commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, wife, slaves, ox, donkey, or any other property, condones slavery and treating women as property. The commandments also admit important ideas about condemning racism, sexual assault, child and spouse abuse, and torture. So that's one of the main problem I see with the Ten Commandments. I would not consider this virtuous. And here I'm talking about the commandments from Exodus 20. There are other commandments also, because the Hebrew Bible has 613 commandments, and the others, some others in Exodus 34 are called the Ten Commandments, not these. The most interesting commandment there is, and they're all anachronistic, is thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. That's one of my favorites.
I can confidently say I haven't broken that one, so it's a point for me. You know, it's interesting you say, you know, Senator Scott back in the day tried this. This has been attempted a number of times in our state and others. I mean, with apologies for quoting scripture, there is really nothing new under the sun.
Right. America's founders weren't perfect, but they knew religious persecution. And so they set up our republic with only three mentions of religion in the Constitution. One was barring a religious test for office, and then the other two are the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses. The Constitution is really clear that the power in our system of government comes from the people, not from any god. Yeah, constitutional scholar Andrew Seidel points out that Christian nationalism is un-American. And when you hear what the commandments are, it's clear that they are. The first, you know, in that version of Exodus that Herb quoted, you know, it starts with, I am the Lord your God. That's un-American. We have separation of church and state in this country.
We have the freedom to worship one, many, or no gods.
You know, you cannot have a freedom of religion without a government free from religion. And so when we're fighting for these First Amendment rights, it is not just for those of us like Herb and I who are atheists, but it's for every person in our country, including the Christians, who really cannot have a freedom of religion without that freedom from religion.
Hmm. Well, Herb and Bonnie, you've both been involved in fights for freedom from religion as well as freedom of religion for a while now. I know you both have probably some war stories to tell. What are some of the most egregious infringements on that freedom that you've seen, or even just attempts at infringing on that freedom here in South Carolina?
Well, right now, white Christian nationalists are trying to claim that we are or should be a Christian nation, and they're trying to pass laws to reflect this. And we need to publicize how this conflicts with our democratic ideals and fight these attempts in any way we can.
Paul, I think a lot of people don't realize how many of the issues that we're facing now are related to religion. So when you look at abortion, for example, you know, taking away women's rights to bodily autonomy has 100% to do with religion. There's nothing medical about the first quote unquote heartbeat, for example. You know, it's not a medical decision or scientific decision about when life begins. That's a philosophical and religious decision. It sounds like they may be coming after birth control. The white Christian nationalists are, you know, really trying to suppress LGBTQ rights. And again, that's based on religion. They're trying to erase Black history and all kinds of equal rights for minority groups. And one of the things people don't know, we could talk a little bit about this data, but these white Christian nationalists, the reason we use the word white is that it is really rooted in white supremacy related to religion. And then you can see the book bans and the other attempts to censor history. And again, all of that is suppressing freedom of thought, because in order for people to follow very strict high control religions like white evangelical Christianity, you have to keep them from learning much about people who are different from them or different sets of ideas. So all of these major things are about religion and about entangling government and religion.
And when you mention white Christian nationalism, emphasis on white, we see how the people are hanging up their Confederate flags and promoting the Confederacy.
Yep.
Another tale as old as time here in South Carolina.
I don't know if people understand white Christian nationalism, so I just want to talk a little bit about that. There's really good data from the Public Religion Research Institute, and I'm going to oversimplify a bit, but about 40% of the people in South Carolina support Christian nationalism. And what that means is that they agree to some extent or another with these five statements. One is that the U.S. government should declare America a Christian nation, that the U.S. laws should be based on Christian values. If the U.S. moves away from our Christian foundations, we won't have a country anymore. Being Christian is an important part of being truly American. God has called Christians to exercise dominion over all areas of American society. And one of the things that's really important about that is the data also show that Christian nationalists are about twice as likely to justify political violence. So let me say that again. Christian nationalists are about twice as likely to justify political violence.
Yeah, I appreciate you spelling it out like that. I think there are certain words and phrases that can be trotted out like boogeymen, but when we talk about white Christian nationalism, you know, it's referring to a specific set of beliefs that is widespread and whose effects we're already seeing in South Carolina.
And many Christians are also opposed to white Christian nationalism.
Right. Myself among them. Yeah, I know that certainly a lot of Christians don't want to be lumped in with trends like that. Well, Herb, I want to take a step back and talk about a really important piece of our history as a state, our history as an affiliate of the ACLU, and a piece of precedent in state law that you were a vital part of. So you were the plaintiff in a landmark religious freedom case where the ACLU of South Carolina served as legal counsel. This was Silverman v. Campbell. To set the stage for me, the year was 1992, maybe we could back it up a little earlier than that if we wanted, but at any rate, in the early 90s, you were a math professor at the College of Charleston, and then you entered public life in a pretty dramatic way. What did you do that put you in conflict with the state of South Carolina?
Well, a colleague of mine at the College of Charleston showed me the state constitution that declared me ineligible to run for governor because I was an atheist. So I went to our local ACLU to see how this obviously unconstitutional provision could be changed. A lawyer there told me that an atheist would need to mount a legal challenge by running for governor, and he said that the very best candidate would be me. Well, I looked around and didn't see any competition at that time. So after giving it some thought, I agreed to become the candidate without a prayer, that which is also the title of my autobiography, which you can see on Amazon if you're interested. But finally, in South Carolina, Supreme Court ruled unanimously in my favor, nullifying the anti-atheist clause in the South Carolina Constitution. All of the credit for this goes to my lawyers in the ACLU, with Armin Derfner being the lead lawyer in this case. I was just having fun giving talks and writing about my experiences. Whenever I got media attention, I'd hear from a number of people who thought they were the only atheists in South Carolina. So I took names, and then at that time, I became the founding president of the Secular Humanists of the Low Country in 1994. During my campaign, I heard stereotypical comments that atheists are mean and angry protesters who do nothing but ridicule religion. I wanted to show that we do have a sense of humor. So here are some questions I was asked during my campaign and my answers. What would be the first thing you would do if you were elected governor? Demand a recount. What would make you believe in God? Perhaps if I won the election, it would take that kind of miracle. What do you think is going to happen to you when you die? I know exactly what's going to happen. I'm going to medical school, just like my Jewish mother always wanted me to do. I hope to use my body parts to their fullest when I'm alive, but I hope other people can make good use of them when I'm dead. Now, during my legal battle, I learned about and joined several national atheist and humanist organizations that all promoted causes I supported, like separation of religion, government, and increasing the visibility of and respect for free thinkers. However, each organization was doing its own thing without recognizing or cooperating with worthwhile efforts of like-minded groups. I thought these diverse organizations would accomplish more by showing strength in numbers and working together on those issues to bring about cultural and political change. So in 2002, I helped form the Secular Coalition for America and became its founding president. They have 19 national secular organizations as members, covering the full spectrum of our movement. It also represents hundreds of local secular communities. It was the first organization to hire a lobbyist to take our issues to Congress. And there is also now a Congressional Free Thought Caucus with 21 members and is growing.
And all that came from your campaign without a prayer.
for being the candidate without a prayer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Herb, in the times that I've met you, going back to when I was a journalist and got to interview you a few times, I only ever knew you as a very outspoken, unapologetic, and I would add a very winsome secular humanist. But I didn't know you in the early 90s or before you entered this public campaign phase of your life. After going public, after filing the lawsuit, did you face any backlash, either on campus, in the community, in your family?
Yeah. Well, what happened? In 1990, you wanted me to do the 90s, I submitted a petition signed by 50 faculty members to stop prayer at the College of Charleston graduation ceremonies. The president there at first agreed, then changed his mind when there were a lot of angry letters. The way I wound up protesting it when I went to graduation, I had a sign that I held up that says, "Atheist on board." Now, I thought that was a perfect kind of protest because the people who were praying had their head bowed and they didn't see the sign. But there were others who were looking around and they happened to notice my sign. And some of them came up to me afterward and they also joined our atheist movement. The next president, who was Alex Sanders, did not begin graduation ceremonies with a prayer. So that ended that. And I did get a lot of hate mail, as you might expect, including a sign placed on my office door that said, "Atheist shithead." All the College of Charleston told me to do is to indicate when I went around speaking that they did not support my extracurricular activities. And that was fine with me. They didn't have to support it, as long as they didn't object to me going around and giving talks. I also helped start a brave college group called the Atheist Humanist Alliance, which is still active at the College of Charleston.
Well, skipping ahead a little bit to your campaign for governor, going back and reading some of the news coverage, and I reread an essay you wrote about this time in your life once, you know, some of the headlines would describe you as some variation on an open atheist or an admitted atheist, which is a very revealing turn of phrase.
Hey, right? Admitted atheist. I would say something like, why don't you ever introduce somebody as an admitted Catholic? And the idea that people would not admit they were, that's not unusual, because I think at that time, almost all atheists were in the closet about being atheists. And my goal was to have people come out of the closet, just as it worked with the LGBTQ community. Because if more atheists come out of the closet, I think people are going to recognize their friends and neighbors and even some family members are atheists. And they'll stop demonizing us. That's my hope.
So with the recognition that we're not lawyers here, I think there are some basic things we should address in the law and in terms of the constitutional issues at play here. The specific language at issue in your case was from the South Carolina state constitution, which says in two different sections that no person who denies the existence of the supreme being shall hold any office under this constitution. What are the basic problems that you see with that language?
Well, the fact that we have freedom of and freedom from religion, and the state Supreme Court agreed with me when they overturned that provision in the South Carolina Constitution, which to me is clearly unconstitutional. It violates the First Amendment in our Constitution, the Free Exercise Clause, and also Article 6, Section 3, that bans religious tests for public office.
Coming back to something Bonnie said earlier, a law like that is just simply un-American.
Right.
So, yeah, we gave away the ending, but yeah, the South Carolina Supreme Court ultimately agreed with you, agreed with the case that our lawyer argued, and unanimously ruled that the religious oath requirement could not be enforced. There was an odd wrinkle in the case, as I understand it, where ultimately you had to file to become a public notary.
Yes.
You know, that was actually the sticking point, not the run for governor, but you were trying to get the right to have a stamp and notarize documents. Mm-hmm. tell me about that.
Well, actually, when I lost the in court initially, in the lower court, they said they would not rule on my case for governor unless I won the election, which of course I lost. But then my lawyer showed me that there's another clause in the state constitution that doesn't allow any public official to be an atheist. And so I applied for the only position that would be easy to win. And that's I applied to become a notary public, figuring once I was declared a notary public, they would take the case. Hmm. But initially, the governor refused to give me my notary license because of what our state constitution says. So that's where my battle was then, to become a notary public. Not that I really wanted to stamp documents, although it turned out that that was pretty good for me. No, I met a lot of people who were atheists and they wanted to have me stamp their documents. And I also, as a notary, stamped 10 people. I approved their marriages. Mm. So I got to marry people. And what's interesting, of the 10 people, so far, nobody has had a divorce among that, which is very rare.
That's a good batting average. Most pastors can't claim that, so hats off to you.
So I still use my notary certificate for different occasions.
Well, how did it feel to see your cause vindicated? I mean, to take this all the way up into direct conflict with Governor Carol Campbell, to take this all the way to the highest court in the state, what was that like for you?
Well, of course, it felt great knowing that when I won, and I was happy to take it wherever it would lead. And I knew I had, but the battle isn't over because I still have a lot of work to do to promote secularism. While our community is growing rapidly, we're still severely underrepresented in politics. We need to encourage more members of our free thought community to run for public office, and also encourage elected officials to come to acknowledge their non-belief, because we know there are a lot of people in Congress who are atheists, but they won't say. We've heard that privately from people who have been dealing with Congress.
Yeah, that's a real recurring theme in our work on civil liberties, is that we do win some important battles, but the war is never really over. You have to keep taking up these fights. That's how we save our freedoms. I want to turn to Bonnie. You have a pretty recent story to share. You know, you get involved in a lot of different work on behalf of the community. And until recently, in the Charleston County School District, you helped lead the Health Advisory Committee, which helps make sure that students have access to medically accurate and comprehensive health and sex education materials. Tell me a little bit about your time serving on that committee. What were you able to accomplish? And then how did that come to an end?
Yeah, I'm going to start back 1 year prior in 2022-2023 school year before I talk about the Health Advisory Committee, because in that year, secular humanists of the Lowcountry and many people in the community stood up to this Charleston County School Board, which was trying to implement a prayer policy at the school board. And that's clearly unconstitutional. There's a lot of details about how they were going to do that, so we don't have to get into those details. But we fought that policy, and the community was against the prayer policy. They did not want the school board members praying before the school board meetings, and we lost. But one of the things in activism is sometimes, just as you were saying, you have to keep fighting. Sometimes you win a victory that doesn't seem like a victory. And one of the things that has not happened in this school year is prayer before the school board meetings. So even though they passed the policy, they have not actually prayed before school board meetings. So I think that that was a good outcome, even though it might have seemed like a loss. And it helped me connect with a lot of activists who are primarily working in the education space. Now, before that, I had joined the Health Advisory Committee. One of the things that's important to know about that is there's a Health Advisory Committee in every county in the state of South Carolina. These committees are constituted by state law. And by state law, the committee is made of two teachers, two students, two parents, two medical professionals, two community members, and wait for it, three clergy members. So this is for public schools, but there are clergy by state law on this committee. We had been pretty lucky in that we had excellent clergy on the health advisory committee who were interested in inclusivity and everybody's need for comprehensive sex education. And so as a committee, we had passed a really good comprehensive sex education bill that's the best it can possibly be given the limitations of South Carolina's state law. What happened in the 2023-2024 school year is that the five-seat conservative school board majority attempted to remove us all illegally. And who they removed, I think, is really important because they removed people with expertise. So I have a PhD in psychology. They removed another psychology PhD, Dr. Lisa Ross, at the college. They removed a nurse. They removed a rabbi. And in their initial round, they removed Reverend Jeremy Rutledge, although he eventually ended up back on the committee. And so they were removing people with expertise, and I think they thought that if they got rid of us, that then they could probably roll back the comprehensive sex education. So now several of us who are removed are actually suing the Charleston County School District because they removed us improperly. For one, they violated FOIA laws, the Freedom of Information Act, when they did not publicly notice that they planned to remove us. And they removed some of us even though we were midterm. And this might feel a little bit in the weeds, but they follow Robert's Rules of Order for what's not in their board policies, except they didn't. Robert's Rules of Orders has about 150 years of experience in legislative bodies. And one of the things it says is that you can't remove committee members in the middle of their terms without making allegations of wrongdoing and affording them due process. Why that's important is that if you can remove committee members at any point, no matter what, and just replace them, then you have a bunch of people who will just in advance do whatever the school board wants them to do for fear of being removed. So it's pretty chilling. And so I hope that what will happen in this lawsuit is that the board and the district will realize that freedom of thought is important and will apologize to the community.
Yeah. Thank you for sticking with that fight. I've really appreciated people like you who keep showing up, sharing the expertise you have, and then speaking out when people's rights are being violated. Beyond Charleston County, I know you take an interest in issues that affect all South Carolinians. And you made the trip up to Columbia this year during some of the legislative debates about the rights of LGBTQ people, especially when it came to the rights of trans youth and their families. I was wondering if you could just speak about what spurred you to action and what you witnessed when you traveled to attend those hearings.
I know and love a number of trans people, and I know that they are just people. And so when this bill, the Trans Kids Bill, H4624, came up, I knew I wanted to go to the State House when I could. So I was there the day after public testimony, in which the public, including trans people and their families, along with medical professionals, overwhelmingly testified about how harmful the bill is. You know, trans kids, when they get the affirmation and support that they need, are so much happier and healthier. And we know that the suicide rate is very high among trans youth. And the legislature is attacking them. And they're doing it for no reason, because, first of all, there are no surgeries happening for gender-affirming care among kids, and there weren't ever. And 1% of the population approximately is transgender. So they're really going after a problem that doesn't exist, when South Carolina has plenty of problems that do exist. And so there was all this testimony, and the medical professionals and the families all said, you know, don't pass this bill, it's harmful. And they explained all the reasons why. I think that that day, particular day, there was one person testifying for the bill, and they were from an out-of-state hate group who, you know, called in basically to testify against the bill. So I was there the next day, and the legislators who were pushing this bill were repeating the same debunked points of view that we knew at this point they knew were ridiculous, because they had heard all of that testimony the day before. And it felt like gaslighting. I got so angry, and I'm generally pretty even-tempered, but I was about to yell in the middle of a committee meeting at the State House. And so I got up and went out crying. And of course, other activists came and were wonderful and amazing, and I got myself together. But it was infuriating, the gaslighting. One of the things about that bill is they out kids. The bill passed, by the way, and Governor McMaster signed it. And the bill will out kids who are exploring gender at school to their parents. And that's really dangerous. Kids are gonna be hurt because of this, because some parents are not affirming of their trans kids. And it puts teachers in a terrible position. I think this is part of what is important to understand, that even if this bill hadn't passed, I think a lot of these bills are meant to just get people to comply in advance with what these white Christian nationalists want. And so even if the bill hadn't passed, I think teachers probably would be a lot more careful about talking about gender to kids. And sometimes kids bring those things up and they really need someone supportive to talk to. In these times, I always go back to Professor Timothy Snyder's book On Tyranny, 20 Lessons for the 21st Century. It's a great book and it's short. I think everyone should read it. It's a very short book, but the first lesson is don't comply in advance. And I'm afraid that a lot of what happens is that people see these bills, and whether they pass or not, they start to comply in advance with what the white Christian nationalists want. And that's dangerous.
Well, I was there in some of those hearings as well. And there were definitely times that I felt like yelling. It's so absurd. As you said, we're a state with real problems that we could be solving. But instead, this year, the very first and very last day of legislative session, we're consumed with debate about a bill targeting and taking rights away from a very small community in this state. And it's appalling. I think I appreciate you being there. I appreciate you not yelling, but summoning up the wherewithal to testify, to share your expertise. So thank you for being there. Well, on the topic of state house politics, I used to be an education reporter, and in the 2010s especially, I remember perennial debates about quote-unquote teaching the controversy on evolution. At first, it was trendy for lawmakers to introduce bills or resolutions about adding a chapter on creationism to biology textbooks in high school. They shifted tactics and terminology a little bit, called it intelligent design. And again, the professors and teachers and scientists would have to travel to Columbia and go talk to them about what the science says and what the Constitution says. What did you learn from that era of activism? And what were some effective ways to counteract those types of bills and their backers?
Well, we had to show that there's no controversy about evolution within science. The only controversy about evolution is in politics and the believers who want to ignore the science of it.
Bonnie, was this a fight that you were engaged in at the time?
I was not, but what it makes me think about is how we understand truth and reality. And that's what we use science for. It's a process to understand reality that everybody can agree upon. And it might take some time, and things change over time. Our ability to understand reality changes, but scientists can get together and look at the body of research and understand what we know and what we don't know. Religion, on the other hand, is completely untestable. It's about faith, and people can believe whatever they want, but you can see that even Christians don't agree on what it means to be a Christian. And so because it's unreliable in that way, and I don't mean that in a, I mean that in a scientific sense. So reliability is being able to get the same results over and over again, because you can't in religion discover truths that are reliable and believed by most people. It's not a good system for governing ourselves.
You know, during those debates, I know that there were religious people who also traveled to Colombia to speak against bills like that, you know, bills advancing creationism. I remember in particular one Presbyterian who was a biology professor at CFC who always spoke up. And I know that both of you have mentioned times where you found common cause with people of faith, even with congregations from time to time. I was wondering if you could share a little bit about your approach to working alongside religious folks.
Well, what I always look for is religious organizations that are working on projects that I agree with. And sometimes I try to work with them. I could tell you what happened in 1988 when Habitat for Humanity, which builds houses for poor people, Jimmy Carter was in Atlanta doing it, and he advertised for people who should go there. So I went there and worked with Jimmy Carter, and I really respect Jimmy Carter, so it was good being there. One problem that occurred, Millard Fuller, who was the president of Habitat for Humanity, led us in daily prayers at breakfast, lunch, and dinner every night. And I told him that he could get more followers if it was less religious oriented. And he said, that's the reason he joined. If it weren't for Jesus, I wouldn't be in Habitat for Humanity. I much preferred Jimmy Carter's viewpoint. Each night we would walk in to dinner at different African-American churches. Once I walked in with Jimmy Carter, and there was a standing ovation. So I said to Jimmy, I hope you don't mind. This happens wherever I go. I still like Jimmy Carter, even though he didn't laugh at my little joke. Now, in terms of Unitarians, I joined the Unitarian Church. They were the first organization that invited me to speak during my campaign. And it turned out that going there was one of the best things that ever happened to me. After I gave my talk, a woman named Sharon came up to me and said, I'd like to volunteer to help in your campaign. So I said, sure. I then made her my campaign manager because I didn't have any other volunteers. And when I lost the election for governor, I blamed Sharon for losing, which sounds like something Jimmy, that our former president would say, only he'd expect people to believe him. But the one good thing with Sharon is I wound up marrying her, Sharon Frati Pietro, and we've been together ever since 1990. When I was running. So I owe it to the Unitarian Church where I spoke.
Well, I'm glad you and Sharon patched things over after the campaign. It seems to have really worked out.
I am always so grateful to religious people when they are fighting for First Amendment rights. And in the battle over the Health Advisory Committee, I mentioned I was serving with Rabbi Greg Cantor and Reverend Jeremy Rutledge. And we were all three, at least in the initial round, ejected from the Health Advisory Committee together. And so we wrote an op-ed to the Post-Dem Courier, which we fondly called the a pastor, a reverend, and an atheist walk into a bar op-ed, which started with the phrase, "We are a pastor, a rabbi, and an atheist who love working together."
Yeah, a dream team. Well, if I can share one story about my sort of education in college, I went to the University of South Carolina. There's a group on campus called the Pastafarians, which I think is similar probably to the AHA at College of Charleston. Yeah. You know, it was very tongue in cheek. They, you know, they purported to worship the flying spaghetti monster. It was very satirical about religion, but what it really was a humanist group, a group of people who did not believe in a God and who needed some community and some solidarity, and who also did a lot of good work. You know, they did service to the community. And at the time, I was a very devout evangelical, and I got it in my head somehow that my mission was to preach to these people, to attend their meetings, join their ranks, and win them over to my side. And you would probably find me, you would find 19-year-old me very obnoxious for this reason. But I went, and I didn't conceal what I was doing. I was very upfront about who I was. And what happened was that this group of people welcomed me with open arms. And I kept attending their meetings, and they shared with me and shared with each other stories about growing up, as many of them did in South Carolina, as people who felt that they were the only atheists in their school or their town or their state, and feeling isolated, feeling like second-class citizens, feeling that people like me were constantly judging them. And through that time, my batting average was zero. I converted nobody. But I met these people who demonstrated hospitality, care for the stranger in ways that I didn't always see the Christian church actually doing. And because of that experience, I still have such an affection for people who are comfortable speaking out as humanists, expressing their values, living out those values. Those have been some of the dearest friends I've met along the way. All that to say, I have thought and never fully understood about the distinction between the words atheist and humanist. And I know that's, you know, that's central to your organizations. How would you explain that, you know, in your own terms, in ways that you've tried to live it out in your lives? What does it mean to be a humanist?
Well, I would say an atheist is just someone who has no belief in any gods. So that's the negative side. The humanist is the positive side of the same coin. We are good without any gods, so we try to do good works. Now, atheists and humanists both try to do good works, mostly. So I'd say they're pretty similar. And people will use one word or the other, whichever they're most comfortable with. I think some people don't like to use the word atheist because it sounds so negative, so they say humanist. But I'm happy to use either.
Yeah, I didn't know what humanism was until well into my adulthood. But I think many people, including many Christians, can really identify with humanist values. So those are things like responsibility and empathy. I think the difference in responsibility might be that since atheists don't believe in any gods, we believe that whatever problems humanity has is our responsibility to fix, and no one else is going to do it. We value peace and social justice and environmentalism. and altruism and critical thinking.
And this is one reason I think it's good for atheists and humanists to work with religious people, because then they find out what we really are like, and they don't demonize us like they learned when they were young, that we're just ordinary people who happen not believe in any gods, but we do good works. And what you do is what's more important than what you say you believe.
Well, one last question for you, and our development director, I'm sure, would have words for me if I didn't ask you about this. I understand that both of you are financial supporters of the ACLU of South Carolina. And first of all, thank you. Really, thank you. That's a big part of what keeps us going. So thank you sincerely for your support. But I was wondering if you could share a little bit about why you decided to give, what inspires you to stay engaged in this fight.
When I'm educating or advocating for the First Amendment, the ACLU is there on the ground, whether it's at the school board or the state house. So I know my donations are well used to defend my civil liberties and those of other vulnerable people in South Carolina.
Yeah, whenever the Secular Coalition is fighting a battle in COP and Capitol Hill, ACLU is often part of it. There are two organizations that help out a lot. That's ACLU and Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And I'm a supporter of both of them. And the ACLU has always done a great job. Without the ACLU, I wouldn't have been involved with running for governor, because nobody else was willing to take my case at the time.
Well, thank you both again for supporting our work, for sharing your stories today. I've really enjoyed this. So thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of While I Breathe, a podcast production of the ACLU of South Carolina. As you may know, we are in the legislative off-season, but state lawmakers are already cooking up bills to restrict the freedom of religion and freedom from religion, and you gotta know we'll be watching them like a hawk.
If you would like to receive occasional updates from our team about goings-on in the State House and ways you can protect civil liberties, you can sign up for our email list by going to aclusc.org and entering your email address in the little box at the top of the page. I'm the guy who writes our email updates, and I try to give clear calls to action when we have them. I also try not to broadcast a lot of doom and gloom, because there's certainly enough of that in the atmosphere already. This week, we're sending out a short email update about our newly announced 2024 Advocate of the Year Award, which we presented to the family of the late Eric Childs. Our advocacy director, Josh, wrote a really moving tribute to Eric's steadfast work and friendship, and it's genuinely one of the most inspiring things I've read this year.
Y'all, thanks for listening to the podcast, and until next time, while I breathe, I hope.
Amendment 1.